to be used against him by Richard March. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Om123. To be used against him by Richard March. 1. A traveling companion. When the train left to Liverpool Street, he and I were the only occupants of the compartment. I was in one corner, he was directly opposite me in the other. He appeared to have purchased the same evening papers which I had purchased. I noticed too a certain similarity in his movements to mine. When I lowered my paper, he lowered his. When I turned a page, he turned one also. This coincidence of action I supposed at first was accidental. But I perceived ere long that, if it was accidental, the accident was of a peculiar kind. Whatever I did, he did. When I exchanged one journal for another, he exchanged one also. I noticed in this respect that the imitation was so close that, when I relinquished the Pall Mall for the St. James's, he relinquished the Pall Mall for the St. James's. When I put my paper down and looked at him, he put his paper down and looked at me. I asked myself if this person intended to insult me. What conceivable reason could he have for entering a railway carriage with the apparently deliberate intention of insulting an inoffensive stranger, unless he was drunk or mad? Directly I began to observe him, I was struck by the fact that he resembled someone whom I had seen before. Who it was I couldn't for the instant recollect. I eyed him while he eyed me, endeavoring to recall to my mind who was the owner of his features. I believe that I have had the pleasure of meeting you before. When I addressed to him this commonplace, which so frequently is addressed to individuals whose personality one fails to recollect, to my surprise he replied to me in exactly the same words which I had used. I believe that I have had the pleasure of meeting you before. The tones of his voice were familiar to me. I had not only heard them before, but I had heard them recently. You are laughing at me because I cannot recollect your face. And yet it is proverbial among my friends that I have an excellent memory for faces. Scarcely had I finished speaking than he cured me. He repeated after me word for word what I had said. The man must be a mountebank, and yet the longer I looked at him, the better I seemed to know his face. Who was the fellow? May I venture to ask your name? The only reply which I received to my inquiry was my inquiry cured. The man must be some clowning spirit, who in revenge perhaps for my bad memory proposed to amuse himself a little at my expense. When you are pleased to be more communicative, I will endeavor to apologize for my imperfect recollection. When you are pleased to be more communicative, I will endeavor to apologize, came the echo from the opposite corner. I confess that I was conscious of a certain feeling of irritation. The mildest of men does not care to be mocked, and I am not prepared to say that I am the mildest of men. Still, I didn't propose to have in a railway carriage any unpleasantness with a man who, after all, might be a perfect stranger to me. So I gathered my papers and wraps together and withdrew to the other end of the carriage. Scarcely had I done so when the man who had been in front of me did likewise. He gathered his papers and his wraps. He came and planted himself in front of me at this end, as he had done at that. There could be no doubt that the action was intended to be impertinent. The thing was done too deliberately to admit of any other supposition. Still, I was not prepared to show resentment. I did not see how I could do so, that is, with any regard to my own dignity. I could scarcely have a vulgar squabble with the fellow then and there. The boat train does not stop between London and Harwich. We were compulsory companions while the journey lasted, unless I threw him out of the carriage window or he threw me. Better to endure his insolence, unless it became aggressive, until we reached our destination. I became tired of reading. I put down my paper. The man in front of me, in pursuance of his apparent policy of faithful imitation, simultaneously put down his. He returned the look with which I favored him. But to that I was indifferent. I continued intently to study his countenance, asking myself when and where, before meeting in that carriage, I had encountered him before. He looked a gentleman. I was prepared to admit that he was a gentleman. He had about him that indefinable something which had the trained observer inevitably associates with his idea of a gentleman. He was probably between 30 and 40 years of age. He was good-looking, with a long, sallow, oval face, which was innocent of moustache and whiskers, and a very curious mouth and chin. I think it was the peculiarity of that mouth and chin which impressed one with a consciousness that he might not be an agreeable man to quarrel with. There was something about the formation of the lower part of his face which was suggestive, though only to my imagination, perhaps, of cool, calculating, unflinching cruelty. I say that this might have been a suggestion of my imagination, but his eyes conveyed not merely a suggestion, but an absolute certainty. They were the most beautiful eyes which I had ever seen. They were large and black, jet black and deep, so deep that it seemed impossible to penetrate their depths. The pupils had a curious streak of dilatation like a cat's. They were large at first, and seemed to gleam with light. As you observed them, they grew perceptibly smaller, until a point remained, a point of light. No man could look at that man's eyes and doubt that he was as cruel as the grave. The unflinching way in which he met my gaze had a curious effect upon my nerves, though I am far from being a nervous man. The more I continued to observe him, the more persuaded I became that we had met before, not once, but constantly. So firmly were his features impressed upon some mislaid tablet of my memory. Yet, try how I would, I could neither remember where I had seen him nor who he was. This was the more extraordinary, because he was possessed of so distinct an individuality that one was disposed to say that one need only set eyes upon him once, never to forget him. I could restrain my curiosity no longer. I leaned forward and, regarding him fixedly, I said, "Don't I know you?" He leaned forward and, regarding me fixedly, replied, "Don't I know you?" It was but an echo. The man persisted in his mockery, and yet the tones of his voice, with what a strange familiarity they seemed to ring in my ears, and at the same time how they grated on my nerves, how they filled me with a sense of irritation. He had advanced his face to within a few inches of my own. In the irritation of the moment, I was more than half disposed to strike him. The palm of my hand itched to salute his ears. I believe that I should have struck him, had I not all at once become conscious of the look which was in his eyes. The pupils grew and grew until they glared at me like a wild beast, then like a man. I drew back in my seat, stifling an exclamation. There could be no doubt whatever that murder was in the man's eyes, that he was mad. I lost him when we reached Harwich. I went at once to the Antwerp boat. The night was glorious. I remained on deck while the boat was being cast from her moorings. After she was out in the river, after she was out in the sea. I had no desire for a cabin. I did not trouble myself even to secure a berth. I had no desire for slumber. I, of course, was conscious that in my peculiar circumstances, sleep was a factor not to be neglected. Without a proper amount of sleep, a man's nervous system is bound to suffer, and when his nervous system suffers, the man suffers altogether. He loses perfect control of his mental faculties. To keep perfect control of my mental faculties was, to one in my position, literally a question of life or death. It is, I firmly believe, only when a man loses perfect control of his mental faculties that the police score what they call their successes. Therefore, to me, a proper amount of sleep was indispensable. But at the same time, I was aware of what was the exact amount I did require, and I knew that I wanted none just then. I was in no mood for slumber. I was in a mood to enjoy the perfect night, the fresh breezes, and the smell of the sea. And I was in a mood after a while to think of Alan Foster. I wondered if he was still lying where I left him, with his face to the ceiling. I am quite willing to admit that I felt a certain satisfaction in picturing him to my mind's eye exactly as I left him. I felt a certain pleasure in painting as vivid a picture as my imagination would allow me of the room in which I left him. A picture of the little details of the room, his chair and mine, the shaded lamp upon the table, the look upon his face when in that last swift moment he understood that I meant business, the inanimate thud with which he had banged on the floor. I wondered if he had made much mess, whether I ought to picture him with or without the chance of a crimson pool. If I had possessed the secrets of the magicians, I would have travelled back for an instant just to see. I had frequently speculated as to what would be the sensations of a man in my position. I do not know that there was anything remarkable about my own. I should say, in no extraordinary sense, that my sensations were those of satisfaction. When I had had enough of thinking of my last meetings with Alan Foster, my thoughts recurred to the fellow in the train. As I leaned over the side of the steamer, I taxed my brain with an effort to recollect where I had seen him. Again and again I had almost hit upon his trail, when it again escaped me. I couldn't think who the man might be. I wondered if he was in the boat bound with us for Antwerp, or whether he was journeying in the boat to Rotterdam. Thus wondering, I stood up and, turning to the smoke room, which was just behind me, saw him at my side. I owned that I was startled. I had supposed that I was the only person upon deck. He certainly had not been there a moment back. I had heard no one approach, yet there he was, leaning as I was leaning, with one hand upon the side of the vessel, his eyes fixed intently upon mine. For some moments we continued in silence to observe each other. As we did so, I was conscious that his glance began to fill me with a species of vague discomfort, if I may say so, with a sort of horror. It was absurd to suppose that I should allow him to continue to amuse himself at my expense. I spoke to him. "May I ask, sir, if you have any intention of dodging my steps?" He said nothing. He continued to look at me, and the more he looked at me, the less I liked the look of him. "It is not a fact, sir, that you and I have met before." "It is." The voice in which he uttered the two little monosyllables was such a familiar voice, a voice which was so well known to me that the mere fact of its exceeding familiarity filled me, although it may appear exaggeration on my part to say so, with a vague sense of pain. Surely the sound of that voice has been ringing in my ears for years. "May I ask, sir, where we have met before?" He was silent. Less and less did I like the expression which was in his beautiful eyes. "May I ask, sir, what is your name?" "I have no connection with the police." It is true that the peculiarity of his demeanor, the intentness of his gaze, the sense of discomfort with which I was conscious that his presence began to fill me, had led me inwardly to inquire if the fellow could be in any way connected with the police. But I had not formulated the inquiry in words. How came he, then, to reply to my unspoken query? Could he be connected with the hounds of Scotland Yard? The suspicion of such a possibility filled me with a sudden passion, with one of those ugly rages for which among my friends I believe I am well known. I moved towards him, bent on mischief. As I moved towards him, he moved towards me. His eyes were fixed on mine. I protest that of no man living have I ever been afraid, and of no man dead, of things of flesh, not of things of air. I have never hesitated, even for an instant, to do anything because I was afraid. Witness my career. I protest that, until that moment, I believed myself to be incapable of the thing called fear. But when, in that moment, I met his eyes and saw them well, and in the moonlight clearly, I was afraid. I slunk away and stole into the smoke room and left him there. When I entered the smoke room, still tingling with the consciousness of having played the coward, I found it in the possession of three persons. Two were upon one seat, and had arranged themselves in such a position that each was able to stretch out his feet on the seat in front of him. Both were asleep. The other seat was occupied by a single individual. He also was asleep. He lay stretched out at full length upon the seat in such a manner that at his feet there was only left space enough to enable me to crowd myself in the corner. This vacant space I occupied. As I sat there, in that cramped position, my feelings towards that luxurious individual were not of the friendliest kind. He was evidently in the enjoyment of perfect comfort. He was actually snoring, while he had left me scarcely room enough to breathe. I was telling myself that it would serve him well right if I were to pull his nose with sufficient vigor to rouse him out of his state of selfish stupor to a consciousness of the requirements of the situation, when the door opened and the man came in from whom I had slunk away. He paid no attention to me whatever. He stood looking down at the snoring sleeper. As he looked, the expression of his countenance was simply diabolical. It startled even me as I sat looking on. Lower and lower towards the sleeper he bent his cruel handsome face. Suddenly putting out his hand, he grasped the sleeper's nose and wrung it with such savage ferocity that I half expected to see the nose torn right off the victim's face. No man could continue wrapped in slumber whose nose had been handled in such fashion as that man's nose was handled then. The snorer not only ceased to snore, but he sprang to his feet and emitted a yell which must have been audible throughout the ship. The little apartment was in confusion. We were all of us upon our feet. The sufferer fondled his nose, as well he might. The adjectives which proceeded from his lips my pen is unable to record. "Who did it?" he yelled. "Who did it?" He glared at each of us in turn, as if disposed, in the first paroxysms of his pain, to regard us all there as guilty parties. His actual assailant had vanished like a coward through the door. I was just about to point this out when, to my amazement, the man who had been sleeping just in front of me charged me with the assault. I repelled the charge with all the indignation with which, on the impulse of the moment, I was capable. The man declared that he had seen me do the deed.
"Why," I cried, "only at a loss to conceive what could have induced him even to imagine such a thing. You were asleep." "I was between sleeping and waking," he replied. "I saw you looking at that gentleman. I saw you lean over him, and I saw you pull his nose." If I had not shown the sufferer pretty clearly that discretion upon his part would be the better part of valor, I believe that he would have attacked me there and then. I declared, upon my honor, not only that my accuser lied, but that I was incapable of the conduct with which he charged me. I explained whose was the guilt. The man came in and looked at you, and pulled your nose. Before so completely was I taken by surprise at what seemed to me to be so unprovoked an outrage, I could stop him. He was gone again. We went out to look for the miscreant. We sought for him in all directions, but he was not on deck. No signs of him were to be seen. We asked the watch if he had noticed anybody moving. He declared that he had noticed me, but that with the exception of myself, no one had been on the deck for the last hour or more. It is certain that the sailor was deceived, as he might very easily be in that uncertain light, but the gentleman whose nose had suffered looked at me, as though if he only dared, he would. I know not if the story got about, and if the general verdict was that I was the guilty party, but it certainly seemed to me, throughout the rest of the journey, that the whole of the passengers gave me plenty of elbow room. Not a soul could I get to exchange a word with me during our passage up the Scheldt. Whoever I spoke to immediately found that something required his presence in another portion of the ship. More than once, before we arrived at Antwerp, I was on the point of showing my resentment. But until we drew up at the quay, I never caught even a glimpse of the ruffian for whose outrageous conduct it seemed I was temporarily suffering. I entered the train for Brussels. It seemed, until just as the train was starting, that I was to have the compartment to myself. When the signal had been actually given, and the train was already in motion, the door at the opposite end of the carriage opened, and a man came in who had wrung the unconscious sleeper's nose half off his face. With the calmest air in the world, he came down the carriage and placed himself on the seat in front of me. This was a little more than I could stand. "As you have come in, sir, you must excuse me if I get out." I put my hand through the window to unfasten the door, but the engine had got up steam. We were clear of the station. To have attempted to align would have been to infringe the bylaws of the railway company. I should have found myself in the hands of the authorities. There was nothing for it but to make the best of the situation, and to treat my unwelcome companion with all the philosophy at my command. I put my legs upon the seat. I prepared to take my ease. My companion did exactly as I did. He put his legs upon the seat, and he prepared to take his ease. But I was not to be moved by such a trifle as that. If it was his humor to play the mountebank, his humor caused no sort of inconvenience to me. As the train moved through the flat country which lies between the Antwerp and the Malines and beyond, I, for my part, was wrapped in thought, until the silence was disturbed by my companion. "It's not bad fun, this running away from the police." The fellow's words were so exactly interpreted the thoughts which had been passing through my brain that I could not help but let him see that I was startled. I moved my legs from off the seat, and turned and faced him. Still bent on imitation, he turned himself towards me. The fellow filled me with such a sense of curious repugnance that I was at a loss for words with which to address him. He, however, seemed to be completely at his ease. He began lazily to remove his gloves. Having removed them, he held out towards me his hands. I noticed what white, slender, artist hands they were. "Look at them. They are white enough. They are without a stain, and yet they have dyed in blood." He spoke in the tone of voice which seemed to be so intensely familiar. "They died with the blood of a friend, of the best friend man ever had. I killed him, my best friend." He leaned back in his seat. There was a smile about his lips which seemed to me to be the incarnation of all cruelty. "I killed him because I hated him, and a little, I think, because he loved me so. He had always trusted me, and I had always played him false, and the more I played him false, the more he trusted me. For that, I hated him. I robbed him of his monies, and he pretended that the things which I had stolen had been his gifts to me. For that, I hated him the more. So having robbed him of great things all his life, I robbed him out of pure pastime, of a little thing. I robbed him of his wife. This fool, he loved his wife. He loved her, I do believe, better than his soul. So when he learned what I had done just for the sport of it, he dared to show resentment, for which I killed him there and then. I killed him when his heart was hard with rage against his well-tried friend. That was yesterday at 6. I left him there, just where he fell, upon the floor. I went round to my rooms. I slipped a few things in my dressing bag. I caught the boat train at Liverpool Street. I am en route for Brussels, and after that I know not where." The fellow laughed softly to himself. It was the most dreadful sound I had ever heard. Was he man, or was he devil, that he could read the inmost secrets of my heart, only to make a jest of them like that? It was not his own tale he had told. It was mine. I had slain my friend only a couple of hours before I had met this fellow in the Harwich train. Already I didn't doubt that the avengers of blood flattered themselves that they were upon my heels. How come this man to know what was hidden from all the world but me? I knew not what to say to him. What was there to be said? Unless I took him by the throat and crushed the life from him, I would have done it had I dared. But for the second time in my life my courage failed me. I didn't dare. There was something about this man which I knew so well, it frightened me. I racked my tortured brain with the unanswered, and it seemed unanswerable question. Where had I seen this man before? Not another word was spoken upon either side until we reached Brussels. As the train drew into the station, I rose and said, "Well, is it your intention to accompany me further?" He shrugged his shoulders and he smiled. I went out and I left him sitting there. But all the time as the cab drove through the busy streets to the hotel, I felt as though that man were sitting in the cab there at my side. 2. The Haunted Man. After dinner, by way of a little relaxation, I went to a certain cafe where there are women who sing. I do not pretend that the place was a place of particularly good repute, or that the entertainment which it offered was in any sense worth listening to. As a matter of fact, the performance was execrably bad and abominably dull. Indeed, the place was a vulgar and backward place, and therefore excellently suited to the humor I was in, for I was in a blackguard frame of mind. I sat drinking the poisonous concoction which they call absinthe et alanisthe, while one of the chanteuses, a hideous fat woman, hovered above me and asked for drink. On the table next to mine, there were some papers. I drew them towards me. Among them was a London paper of that day's date. It was uncut. I had travelled quicker than I had, having probably reached Brussels by the Austrian route. Opening it, my eyes searched down the columns. They lighted on a paragraph which was headed, "Dreadful Tragedy in Sackville Street." I read the paragraph. It was a narrative up to the date of Alan Foster's murder. It seemed that they must have discovered the body only a few minutes after I left the house. Alan's man had gone to the room and knocked, and having received no answer, had tried the handle and found that the door was locked. He waited some minutes, then returned, and as he still received no answer to his knocking, fearing that Alan was ill inside the room, he sent for assistance and had the door forced open. Braithwaite had been in the service of Alan's father,